1420 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris and her VP running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, make their joint debut before rally attendees in Philadelphia. Walz stresses unity.
Over those next 91 days and every day in the White House, I'll have Vice President Harris's back.
Daniel Alvarez, a senior advisor for the Trump campaign, says Walz is too liberal.
It is clear that Kamala Harris picked someone who was as far left, weak, failed, and dangerously liberal as she is.
Tropical Storm Debbie, which has killed at least five people, has battered parts of Georgia and South Carolina and moves up the East Coast for much of the week. The storm is weakened, but according to CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson,
I do think that things are going to get worse in North Carolina, and that's really the focus for the next 24 to 36 hours as the storm makes another landfall as it comes back onto shore between South Carolina and North Carolina.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The two major presidential campaigns will hold competing events in Eau Claire Wednesday. Vice President Kamala Harris has had plans to hold a rally in Eau Claire since last week. Late Monday, Republican running mate J.D. Vance also announced plans to speak in Eau Claire. Stay tuned to this Civic Media station for live coverage. Meanwhile, Democrats say they're enthusiastic about having Tim Walz as Harris's running mate. Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler.
We know Tim Walz. He knows us. We love him. Everyone in Wisconsin knows and loves someone like Tim Walz, and I think he's going to be a powerhouse fighter and champion to win this election.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin Republicans are trying to cast Walz as pushing the Democratic Party further to the left. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
To everyone who loves Culver's, the feeling is mutual. I'm Nicole from Culver's of Cross Plains, Wisconsin. And when I'm serving you a Butterburger, I'm just as happy as you are. I almost get giddy when I hear the sizzle of our fresh beef on the grill. Seeing that smile that comes from a meal made just right, some call it magic, but I like to call it love at first bite. Stop in for a cook-to-order Butterburger and let us make Culver's your happy place.
From Wisconsin with love, welcome to Delicious.
Culver's on 8th Street in South Wisconsin Rapids.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Couldn't wait to get here to share a story of a discussion I had today with an older gentleman I've known a couple of years now. Full disclosure, this guy I bought my daughter's house from. You know, he's kind of like the, not going to say slumlord, but he owns a lot of rental properties in the neighborhood. And someone who has been influential in the community for some time. Look, all intents and purposes, good, decent guy. But interestingly enough, lifelong Republican, clearly, Fox News viewer, without question, and you know, consumer of right-wing blather. Oh my gosh, yes. Because he used every buzzword you could. He had the entire talking point agenda in the first 3 minutes of our conversation. And it was one of these situations where he came up and he's going, well, you know, we got to vote for Trump. Trump's going to make the country great. Got to make it again. And I'm going, how so? Because, you know, when I have these conversations, which I enjoy, you know, I know in this world of, you know, my team has to win and red hat, blue hat, and we have to fight each other. I like to know why. Please share. And then I will ask a bunch of questions. And I try not to be, you know, the smart, you know, egghead know-it-all who refutes every point. I just want to know why you think the way you do, how you get there. And he shared with me the story of his life. And yeah, it took that long. But, you know, here's a guy, you know, he's probably in his mid-80s. So he lived through what memorably is one of the greatest moments in the history of humanity, especially for white men. So he has a view of what the country was from, you know, back in the day. It may be a little differently than most, but it was one of possibility. It was one of opportunity. It was one of prosperity. And even he said he's getting out of the landlord game, selling off his properties, because, you know, in his words, everyone's turned into a deadbeat. And it's because, again, his words, because 60% of the population is living paycheck to paycheck. And sadly, in a rental situation, we've decided that people shouldn't be thrown out into the street without, you know, due process. And people like him are, because of the pandemic, have really kind of taken it on the chin. And I do empathize. I don't think we did enough to ensure that they were able to survive. But he's getting away from it. And the idea that, you know, government has ruined everything, and Democrats in particular, ruined everything. And it's because of their policies. He dreams of a world of no regulation. We're going to deregulate everything. We're going to put everything back in the hands of the market. And it got me to thinking about this idea of what a post-governmental world would look like. And I argue right now we're in the second Gilded Age. We have mass inequality in this country because, as he even pointed out, we've got all these billionaires and, you know, things aren't trickling down in wages because obviously people, 60% of people are living, according to him, paycheck to paycheck. But the story that he told was one that I would like to get to. I would love to get to a place where education was funded and that you had opportunity and you taught competitive education where we learned stuff. And that higher education was affordable. Because when he told me he went to the Ohio State University, heavy emphasis on the, he paid, as an out-of-state student, $200 a year for an education there. In-state, it was like $90. Out-of-state, about $200. And you go, how did that happen? This is where the disconnect is. I would love to get back to a time where, you know, $200, which was not a minor sum. It would be, you know, a couple thousand dollars a year now. Not the 70 grand, as he pointed out, that the college down the road charges. Not going to name them. But he talked about this idea of an America where workers were prosperous. He talked about an America where entrepreneurial spirit ruled the day. He talked about an America where competition and opportunity were front and center. You know, he has these ideas. But his way to get to it are, you know, deregulate government. Allow the quote-unquote market to decide. Or corporations. Now, interestingly enough, anti-billionaire. And I asked him, this is one of the little snide comments I made. So you're against the billionaires, but you think a billionaire is the answer. Somehow Donald Trump, the billionaire, is going to be the answer to our billionaire problem. And kind of stumped a little bit there. And didn't really go with me on the fact that he grew up in the era when the top marginal tax rate was 92%, that had an effect on the cost of education, the cost of health care. You know, again, when the central premise is we need no government and we need to deregulate, it's this fantasy idea that we're all going to pull together in community and we're all going to get things done. No, someone's going to make the decisions. Someone's going to have the power to manipulate those markets. That invisible hand will be wielded by someone. And if not government, then corporations or the very wealthy. And we're seeing corporate power as we speak. We're seeing a moment where government and corporations are really duking it out. Because you've gotten a Biden administration who's saying, hey, maybe we need to break some of this stuff up. Maybe we need competition back in, oh, I don't know, the grocery industry. Maybe we need in the food industry. Maybe we need more entrants. Maybe we need more competitors to innovate, to do things a little different, to bring prices down, or to hold them in check. So as I was having this conversation, which again, I love having with people that I disagree with, because it helps me understand how they think. And how he thinks is that if we could just go back, to the good old days where we didn't think there was any forces. Now, he didn't, you know, seem to know much about the National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in the 30s. The Fair Labor Standards Act was passed in the 30s. Didn't seem to know much about the rules of capitalism at the time. Just thought, hey, throw up my shingle, start a business, make money. And understand, there have always been regulations. There have always been guardrails. It's like any game. The economy will have rules set by someone. Is it going to be a government that says, hey, we want the best interest for workers, consumers, citizens? Or is it going to be corporations who say, no. We want the benefits. We want the massive increase in profits because there's never enough. We want to grab that quarter and squeeze it till the eagle screams. But the reason I bring this up is we're in a moment. This election is really about what kind of a country do we want to have? Is it the kind of country that we want that's going to have government control, making policies in the name of we the people, or corporations pushing for more profit, more control, more dominance, suppressing wages, destroying conditions, and, well, creating a desperation economy? You know, where 60% of the people are living paycheck to paycheck. It's an interesting thought. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a giant earthquake of sorts has shook the Silicon Valley, especially, because Judge Amat Mehta, I think I'm saying that right, D.C. District Court Judge ruled on Monday that Google doth violated the Sherman Antitrust Act by basically buying its way into everything, all the browsers, devices, all this stuff. And the claim is that making it nearly impossible for other search engines to get any traction. And in his 286-page ruling, he said very clearly, quote, Google is a monopolist and has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. And that clearly, quote, it has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And here to share some thoughts on this big decision, the first major monopoly case in 25 years, kind of a big freaking deal. I've asked Lee Heppner to come talk with us. Lee is the senior legal counsel over at American Economic Liberties Project. You can check out their work at economicliberties.us. Lee, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, great to be here. And yeah, the ground's been shaking here. I'm in San Francisco, ground zero.
So everybody okay, though? Everyone's nobody jumping out of windows or anything like that?
It's a very exciting earthquake. I think generally there's an auspicious air to the ground right now.
Because here's the thing, and you know, I didn't need the good D.C. circuit judge, the D.C. district judge there to tell me it's a monopoly. Everything I touch, you know, it's not even a search engine. It's Google. That's how you know you have a monopoly.
Yeah, it's obviously one of the more ubiquitous monopolies out there. As you just suggested, when you search for anything, it's synonymous with Google. I'm going to go Google that. It's a ubiquitous part of how hundreds of millions of Americans interact with the internet. And so it's going to have a tremendous impact, this decision, and we're really excited to see this outcome today.
Now, what does this mean then? Okay, they're a monopoly. Does this mean we're going to start breaking pieces of it up? Does it mean you're going to do like you did with Microsoft and make them stop, you know, making deals with computer companies like they were doing back years ago? What does this mean, or don't we know really yet?
So that's it's the obvious question. How is this going to change my life? Well, I can't tell you quite yet. The court splits this into two different phases. Today, we just found out that Google is liable. And now we're going to have to wait around and talk a bit about what the remedies should be. But the liability finding today is incredibly significant. As you already said, I mean, this is the first liability in a Section 2 Sherman Act case brought by the government in a quarter century. The last one was the case against Microsoft. It was probably 30 years before that we saw the breakup of AT&T. So this is a generational event here and a really big liability finding today. And we can discuss about what it could mean. We have a lot of thoughts about that.
No, I mean, because look, you know, when the Competitive Enterprise sent me an email today, and a lot of right-wing think tanks, a lot of corporate think tanks were kind of losing their minds, because this is kind of a step into maybe we start looking at other monopolies in the country, and maybe we've got an appetite with this administration and hopefully with a Harris administration to continue to go after these big corporations to kind of break up these big monopolies and bring back competition. But when the Conservative Enterprise or the Competitive Enterprise Institute, when they throw in their two cents and their only argument is, well, you know, people have choice. I don't know that that's really a good argument here, because I don't think they do. And I'll give you an example of why. I remember there being other search engines that made it into our conversation. In fact, my oldest daughter still calls me Jeeves because that whole Ask Jeeves thing, because she thought I knew everything. Again, she was a small child. But, you know, that was a thing back then. Most of that stuff has just gone completely by the wayside. And now Google won.
Yeah, I mean, and you have a really measured decision here by Judge Mehta in this case. And he goes through the facts methodically. There is very little choice in this market. Google has 80% of the general search market. That's higher on mobile phones, where it's about 95%, where Google controls the search market on those phones. So what you really have is the illusion of choice. And Google tried to make a big thing about, oh, well, you can switch your default. You can switch from Google to Bing. You can switch from this to that. The judge wasn't buying it. Actually, one of my favorite anecdotes, and he talks about this, is that Bing is the default on Microsoft Edge, Microsoft's browser. 80% of the searches on Edge go through Bing. That illustrates the power of defaults, that Bing is so powerful when it has the default on its own. So you really see how powerful these defaults are and how they deprive consumers of choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm going to change my default, I know people who still can't change the time on their VCRs. And you're going to expect them. No, I mean, understand the vast majority of users of smartphones, because as you point out, that's the search engine of choice on smartphones. Most of those people, they can barely change the headphone settings or the volume, let alone the default of your browser. I mean, come on.
Yeah, this is what one of the behavioral economists in the case, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Rangel, called choice friction. Theoretically, you can switch your default, but you know who? I mean, I'm not going to pick up my device and go through the 8 steps to switch the default on all these different channels where I'm, you know, searching for this or that. It just doesn't happen. That choice friction is really powerful and has been extremely profitable for Google.
What do you say to the person who goes, I'm okay with this being a monopoly. It's not a big deal. We Google it. It's like Kleenex. Everyone uses Kleenex, even though we know it's tissue paper or whatever the name of it. It's Kleenex. No matter if it's the brand name or not, we're Googling it. We're okay with this being a monopoly. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I think it's really hard to convince people of something that doesn't exist and what Google's monopoly has blocked from existing. I mean, the effect of their monopoly has been to stifle innovation. You've seen other search engines try to implement, you know, various forms of artificial intelligence and enter the market, and they're just blocked by Google's defaults. So we're missing out on a whole lot of innovation. And this is really what you saw after you broke up AT&T. A lot of people credit that with kind of being the sort of impetus for what became the internet, what from the AT&T breakup. Nobody foresaw that when they were breaking up AT&T. You know, this could be similarly such a seismic shift in the way that we interact with the internet and our surroundings. And I think that what this is essentially doing is unlocking a new wave of innovation that could be profoundly important and really cool for consumers.
Yeah, but where I'm trying to figure out is what's the economy for them? They have this monopoly. Most people think, hey, look, I'm using this service. Most people don't think about, and you know, maybe you can help me here. How do they profit from this power of doing a service for me?
Well, advertising is the backbone of so much of our economy, and Google, which was also found to have a monopoly over a market called text search ads, profits immensely from the position it gains in the search monopoly. If they actually, their own models estimated that if they lost their default placement on Apple phones, they would be down over $60 billion in revenue per year. And that money is advertising revenue. That is money that Google really kind of secures in showing you ads. So search is kind of what you experience, but it is actually the lever by which Google extracts a lot of ad revenue, and it makes up a lot of their business.
How much?
Yeah, I said that, $60 billion plus. And that's their own model saying that if they lose that one distribution channel on Apple iPhones, which they pay about $26 billion a year for, according to some testimony that we heard at trial, they lose $60 billion per year if they lose that default agreement. So this is obviously immensely important to Google, and it's the reason why they've paid so much to cement their position.
Yeah. Let me ask you what sounds like a dumb question, because didn't we go through this with Microsoft? Didn't they do the exact same thing and get you know, the monopoly thing? And didn't we do this already? Didn't we decide that you can't have exclusive software on something? Or am I missing something?
Yeah, no, there are a lot of parallels to the case that was filed against Microsoft in 1998. That was really about Microsoft bundling its operating system with its browser. This is kind of very similar. You see Google bundling Android with its search engine to monopolize channels, to pay for you know, the distribution channels on every device manufacturer, whether it's made by Samsung or LG or Apple iPhone. They are monopolizing each of these distribution channels and really kind of bundling their software to prevent other entry. It's got a lot of parallels to the Microsoft case. And when we broke up that, when that case you know, hit the wall in the early 2000s, even though the remedy wasn't that robust in that case, you know, ironically, it kind of gave Google an inroad to become the new dominant player on the internet in the 2000s. It led to Apple's resurgent sort of position in the 2000s. So, you know, the consequence of the Microsoft case, which had a lot of parallels, was really significant to the internet that we experience today. And I think it's too soon to tell, but we are optimistic that we are unlocking a similar vein of innovation today.
Yeah, and Bill Gates isn't on the street corner with a tin cup and pencils, is he?
No. The poor man's been doing okay for himself.
I mean, because Microsoft, even without the monopoly status, they're still competitive, I think, right? They're still making money, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Microsoft's got its own dominance issues. You know, I think the CrowdStrike incident from a couple of weeks ago shows some of the vulnerabilities of, you know, having a single market player dominate so much of an industry. But certainly Microsoft isn't hurting. They're also a big player in the search market. Where they end up from this is going to be interesting. You know, this case wasn't about Microsoft, but it certainly implicates a broader range of competitors in the search engine market.
But, you know, here's the thing. And the reason I bring up Microsoft is because, as you point out, there are some things that, you know, maybe a more aggressive Federal Trade Commission, a more aggressive trust division of the Department of Justice, maybe you want to start looking at, given the fact that you got this first victory. I know the conversations that I've heard with Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor are, we want to start going after it and break up some of these monopoly. Maybe some of the folks in Silicon Valley are looking in the mirror going, am I next?
Well, you know, I already characterized this as a once a generation thing, but that's not necessarily true right now. You have the Justice Department with a major case against Google's ad tech monopoly. You have the Federal Trade Commission going after Meta, Facebook's monopoly over social media. You have the Federal Trade Commission again going after Amazon's monopoly in e-commerce. So a lot of the big tech giants are in the crosshairs. I think what Judge Mehta's opinion provides is hopefully a blueprint for how to approach these cases, how to write a reasoned opinion that avoids any of the pitfalls that could have befallen this case, but might actually be useful in those other cases.
Yeah. So this is a district court. Where does it go next? I mean, this isn't the final word, is it? I mean, there will be an appeal, won't there?
It'll surely be appealed. You know, I think I've been, you know, talking to some colleagues and seeing some of the chatter. The general consensus, even among folks who were not, you know, rooting for the Department of Justice to win on this, is that Judge Mehta's opinion is pretty ironclad, and that it really weighs both sides. You know, it wasn't an absolute win for the Justice Department. They did not rule for the Justice Department on general search advertisements, which was one of the three markets that the Justice Department was claiming Google had a monopoly in. So it is kind of a reasoned, balanced opinion that I think people are hoping is going to hold up well on appeal.
Does it end up before the Supreme Court? I mean, because my mind keeps going to these weird places that we've got a corporatist court. And and again, this is one of those things the right and left don't necessarily agree or disagree on the power of big tech. So for me, this could be an interesting, you know, kind of bellwether case if it were to land at the lap of the Supreme Court. But I as an outsider, a layperson, I doubt that will happen because, as you pointed out, this is a measured decision from what I've been reading.
Well, and it rests on fairly conventional legal theories, you know.
But that doesn't seem to matter to our Supreme Court.
Fair enough. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, the Supreme Court took up a big antitrust case, the Ohio v. Amex case. I think that was 2017 or 2018. And this case relies on a lot of that case, you know, that it cites heavily to that Supreme Court decision. I don't think that the issues of the legal theories that were before the court here were particularly groundbreaking. You know, factual determinations are given a lot of deference on appeal. And a lot of what you see in this case is parsing through the facts and really weighing Google's version of the facts against the Justice Department's version of the facts. And factual determinations, unlike novel determinations of law, are going to be given a lot of weight on appeal, a lot of deference by a higher court.
You know, I know we're just a day away from the decision and it's all new and everyone's still got some thoughts. But any initial reactions to how this will affect the average user, or will they see nothing at all? I mean, you know, I think back to, and we've used that Microsoft case a couple of times. I remember, you know, from my perspective, I've bought a bunch of computers since then. I don't notice as a consumer any real difference. I know I've got a couple of different choices, but, you know, I still get what I need. Do we see any massive swings? This early out, what are we thinking tomorrow is going to look like?
So I don't want to overplay my hand here, but I think it's going to take time to know what happens. And a lot of this, will depend on the remedy in the case. And there are a lot of different tools that the court has at its disposal to rid this market of monopoly and restore competition where it was lost. That is the imperative for the court, is to restore competition. And it's that competitive spark where we start to see exciting, innovative things happen. It might take a few years before we understand the magnitude. We're still trying to understand the magnitude of the Microsoft case from a quarter century ago. But that case, nobody will disagree that case was a landmark seismic shift in the way that we use technology. And I think that this could be the same sort of magnitude of a case.
I don't want you to get into all the political discussions of who, what, where, but is this something that could, you know, depending on who wins in November, is this something that could change the direction of this, or is this on the path where it's going regardless of what we see in November?
Well, you know, the interesting thing here is that this case was actually filed by Bill Barr, Trump's attorney general, at the tail end of Trump's term in office. So, you know, there's obviously a lot of bipartisan support for confronting the abuses of these big tech monopolies. I think that whatever happens, I hope that whatever happens, I mean, this is an immensely popular case. You know, we've seen polling on this case that shows that there's broad bipartisan support for bringing a case like this and for winning a case like this. So honestly, I think we've laid the foundation pretty well. And big tech has, for better or worse, made itself quite the bully in the China shop. So, you know, I think we've laid a good foundation for this progress to continue.
Yeah, they've put themselves in the center of the bullseye, so to speak. And you know, everybody's looking towards them. So they're the popular ones. But for me, I'd like to see that trickle down, which is why I think politically this is still an issue, because I do think the Biden administration has been much better on this. I think Lina Khan, Jonathan Cantor, those folks are better on the antitrust stuff. And maybe we see a bunch of this happening to do what you just said, restore competition into the marketplace, give people more opportunities to engage in entrepreneurial activity, and consumers a better opportunity to get better prices and stuff like that. There's a lot of good things that comes out of competition.
I think that's right. And I don't want to play too much politics, but I do think it's a winning platform.
There you go. Lee, I appreciate the time. I'm sure this is not going to go away. So I'd love to have you come back and share some more thoughts and about the work that you guys do there at the American Economic Liberties Project.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Lee Heppner, Senior Legal Counsel there at the American Economic Liberties Project. Check out their website, economicliberties.us. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this a big deal? Is this a good thing? Or are you concerned that you're not going to be able to Google anything anymore? You won't be able to say, hey, Google, and something will answer you. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Back after this.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Mostly clear skies and light winds for the overnight. Sunrise temperatures near 50 degrees. For your Wednesday, more clouds on the way. Highs will reach the upper 70s, partly sunny and middle 70s for your Thursday. Right now, it's 58.
This is the famous footwear that makes us actually want to go back to school. With the newest styles from all your favorite brands, like Nike, Adidas, Crocs, Converse, New Balance, Birkenstock, and more. You'll find everything kids want, all at prices parents can appreciate. Because you don't have to overspend to make it famous. Famous Footwear even has fit experts in store to make sure you get the right size every time. So for the perfect fit, make it famous. Plus, right now, buy one, get one half off when you shop your local Famous Footwear or famous.com. Some exclusions apply.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I mentioned earlier, the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the rest of the corporate think tank world, they're a little shaken, a little quaking in the boots. And I got to tell you, when that happens, it makes me happy, one. But you know, something's probably going to go right for working people. Whenever the corporatists are a little shaken, probably a good thing. And this decision on Google, I think, is going to be, as we've discussed, going to be an excellent thing down the road. And look, you know, you got to wonder if the monopolists aren't a little shaken. And here to share some thoughts on where we are with yesterday's decision and maybe where it's going to take us. I've asked David Dayan to come talk with us. David is the executive editor of the American Prospect. You can check out their work at prospect.org. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rick.
So let me get your initial reactions to this, because I got to tell you, I think it's kind of a big freaking deal. I know it's a limited decision. I know that there's some stuff that, you know, got through, didn't get through. But the fact that for the first time in 25 years, you're going to see the Justice Department win a pretty sizable antitrust case, I think this is kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal. Google has been named by a federal judge now as a monopolist. It says it is abusing its monopoly power. It violated Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And this case only was to determine liability. Now there'll be a remedy phase where the judge figures out what he's going to do about this as a penalty. But as we have it now, this is as far as we have gone, first time since the Microsoft case in the late 1990s. And it's a real signature win for Joe Biden's Justice Department, and particularly the Antitrust Division. The antitrust enforcers swept in with a new set of ideas and a new aggressiveness about competition policy. They said, we're going to take it to companies like Google. We're going to look at the facts, and we're going to file suit if we need to. And here they did, and they won. And that is just such a rare event in American life over the last quarter century that you have to praise it and look at it as really, really notable.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. It's the Democrats who are now on the side of competition, and where Republicans had taken that space. I don't know if they actually believed it, back in the old days, but it used to be one of the things they talked about. And yet now
something that's interesting in that, Rick, is the fact that this case was initially brought by the Trump Justice Department.
Right.
This particular case on search was from 2020. However, it's this Justice Department, it's Jonathan Cantor at the Antitrust Division, that came up with the ideas and the arguments and the theories that were able to sway a federal judge. So this is bipartisanship in action right here.
So let me ask you, but the Billy Barr part, because my last guest brought that up as well. As I remember this was I don't know that this was really them going, we really care about antitrust as much as we want to go after our political enemy.
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, there is a belief on the right that Google censors individuals associated with the Republican Party, that it downranks them in search. And that was coloring a lot of the reason why it was going after. It was kind of a high level version of working the refs, right? But what we have here is the Jonathan Cantor and his team just reading the antitrust laws and saying, you're violating it. And specifically how they're violating it is by signing, Google signed over a 20-year period, signed all these exclusive deals to become the default setting on every browser, every device. Anytime you wanted to look up search in any particular device or browser, you inevitably were given Google as the default. Now, you could change that, but the fact of the matter is nobody really does. And they paid a massive amount of money to these companies to become the default. They did that because they knew it would make them a monopolist. It was a total of $26.3 billion that Google gave to companies like Apple, wireless companies like AT&T and Verizon, and browser companies like Mozilla. For Mozilla, which is the maker of Firefox, it represented 80% of its total operating revenue.
Wow.
That's what Google was giving to this company just to become the default in search. It was that important to Google because it effectively made them impenetrable within the marketplace. And now they've been called out on it and found guilty.
But I know people will say, David, that's good business. They, they cornered the market. They did what we're supposed to see on. That's what the movie Wall Street told us. Greed is good. Go get
it. It is good business. It just happens to be against the law. I mean, there's no doubt it was good business for Google. They have very high profit margins. They have a $2 trillion market capitalization. It was extremely good business. The problem is that in America, in a market-based country and economy, you're not supposed to be able to buy your way into the top and then keep yourself there through these structured deals. So, I mean, what we're going to figure out in the remedy phase is what the judge wants to do about that. Is he going to unwind these deals? Is he going to say that actually Google needs to be broken up? He could go in a variety of directions here, and the future of competition within the tech industry is at stake.
And I would argue that's a good thing. I believe in competition. It's one of the things that I think that makes us better. I mean, by having a monopoly, I think you end up with stifled innovation, which there's part of me that goes with the coming AI, maybe that's not a bad idea. But I'm curious your thoughts of where this, theoretically could lead us.
Yeah, I mean, in the near term, Google has already announced they're going to appeal. So this is going to go to the D.C. Circuit and then potentially the Supreme Court if it, if nobody gets satisfaction. So this is going to play out over a number of months, if not years. But what we saw in the Microsoft case was that because Microsoft was tied up for years in an antitrust case and found guilty at one point, that they were hesitant to use the same bullying tactics that they were using to dominate the web. And it allowed smaller companies like Google, for example, to get a foothold and to innovate and to create something that was really useful. The initial search engine, at a time when there wasn't really any good search engine, was very useful for consumers. So here we have that situation mirrored again. Now Google has become the monopolist. This trial and the continuing appeals is going to restrict Google's ability to play hardball over and over again. And we're likely to get more innovation out of that, more smaller companies with an opportunity to build something better, to compete on a level playing field, and to bring real benefits to consumers. So I think it's the same thing playing out once again.
So, you know, I'm hearing you go through all this, and my mind is churning through how much these executives must hate the Biden administration, and ultimately Kamala Harris as well, because they've been very aggressive. They did pursue non-compete agreements and ending those. So I can actually see a world where, you know, some of those Google workers in this brave new world that could possibly be could take their knowledge somewhere else and start a, you know, something, maybe the next step up from Google, and really be that competitive wave that does drive innovation. Or am I just thinking too much in the political realm?
I think if you're an engineer in Silicon Valley, if you're someone, you know, at the lower or middle level, you look at this ruling and you say, this is great. I'm going to have an opportunity to, reach my potential, to follow a dream that I had of building something better and getting buy-in for it and not having that stifled by the giants in Silicon Valley. If you're a CEO in Silicon Valley, you're pretty pissed off right now, right? The Biden administration came with a mentality that was different than several of the presidents before them in terms of, we're going to follow the antitrust laws and we're going to use them on behalf of workers, on behalf of entrepreneurs, on behalf of small businesses, and on behalf of the greater economy. And this is part of the reason why these billionaires, people like Reid Hoffman, who was the co-founder of LinkedIn and now sits on the board of Microsoft, is out there saying, hey, maybe Kamala Harris should consider firing Lina Khan, who's the head of the Federal Trade Commission, not the antitrust department of the Justice Department or antitrust division of the Justice Department. But, it's the same group of people with the same mentality and the same approach to competition policy. And guys like Reid Hoffman, who is under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission as we speak, both through his board association with Microsoft and the company that he funded called Inflection, that Microsoft then acquired without going through the proper steps of a merger acquisition. That's why he's upset. He doesn't like this new regime in Washington. He wants to see it gotten rid of. And so he's explicitly asking who could be the next president to help him with that.
Which is why I think it's interesting where you're seeing a lot of the billionaire money and the corporate money going, because Trump would, you know, the guy who wants deregulation, or at least, you know, deregulation for things that affect workers and families and consumers. It's interesting to see where, you know, that guy who seems like in any other period in history would nowhere near be the nominee is someone that they're pushing for.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen this already with respect to the tech industry. So there was this push on Capitol Hill to require TikTok to give up its Chinese ownership and to sell to an American company. And Trump used to be for that until a guy named Jeff Yass, who's out in Pennsylvania, who's a major investor in the U.S. version of TikTok, appealed to Trump and gave him a bunch of money. And then Trump reversed the decision and said, there's no way that TikTok should have to sell. So we see the transactional relationship that Trump has with his donors. And we see a Reid Hoffman trying to set up the same thing on the Democratic side. And he got so much pushback from the progressive part of the coalition, the people that are the Democratic populace who want to see competition policy revive, who want to see antitrust policy revive, people like yourself there, Rick, that he got such pushback that he had to completely backpedal on this. We don't have the same openly transactional relationships. Now, he may go behind closed doors and try to do it, right? Sure. We still have to be vigilant about that. But you couldn't just go out on television and say, fire Lina Khan, and not expect any pushback from the Democratic coalition. And so ultimately, I think the fact that he was so open makes it harder for Kamala Harris to do that, lest she be seen as someone who just kowtows to her donors.
No, it's an excellent point. And it's interesting to me that he went after Lina Khan, who I don't think is involved in this case. This is a Justice Department case. Why didn't he go after Jonathan Cantor instead?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to think about. Cantor and Khan have been virtually indistinguishable in terms of their approach to antitrust policy, in terms of their approach to competition. They co-wrote the new merger guidelines together. They sit on the new task force against illegal pricing together. And one of them happens to be a woman of color and the other happens to be a white guy. So you do the math. You figure out why suddenly Lina Khan is the lightning rod, whereas Jonathan Cantor is not. But, you know, I certainly have my own suspicion.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But I call them the dynamic duo of antitrust. And the hope is that this now becomes infectious, that we start looking at other things that look like monopolies and restore competition to, I don't know, like every other industry that is gouging our eyes out since the pandemic.
I mean, two things on that. First of all, there are active cases right now against Facebook, against Apple, and against Amazon, as well as a second antitrust case against Google. So this has implications for all of those cases for obvious reasons. The other thing is the exclusive dealing that was at the heart of this case happens in all kinds of industries. You know, one of the big ones is groceries. There are these things called slotting fees that grocery stores demand of food companies to put them on the shelves in particular places. So if you want that prime position on the shelf, you have to pay the grocery store, a big sum of money. Yeah. And those slotting fee arrangements, those contracts might be called into question now that a federal judge has said, actually, those violate the antitrust laws. So there are whole sorts of implications here.
So you mean the grocery store doesn't just put stuff where they want them, where they think it's going to be to the best interest of their consumers, because they've got their consumers at heart? They're not going to put their best products forward so that you have the best choices? They don't do that?
Absolutely not. No, there is a whole relationship where typically you have to be a pretty rich company to afford the fees to get the best position on the shelves that are going to be in front of your consumers, rather than like way high on the shelf where you can't even reach it.
Yeah, where
or
my
maybe
wife
at the
can't
very
get it.
Bottom. Yeah. So, you know, it's typical. This is the reason why you walk through a grocery store and you think you have all this choice, but it's really the same 5 or 10 companies that make everything. It's because they feel like they have to get bigger because the grocery sector has gotten bigger and they're demanding higher and higher fees. So that whole relationship now could be called into question. And by the way, at that pricing hearing just last week, Lina Khan said one of the first things she wants to go after is the grocery sector. So this kind of comes full circle here. And there are a lot of CEOs that are probably plenty nervous right now.
No, because it makes sense. I mean, the number one issue on every voter's mind right now is what?
Grocery prices.
Inflation.
Absolutely.
And who's been the driver of inflation? These big monopolistic companies, where you've got two or three, maybe four companies that control an entire industry. That's not competition. That sounds more like the possibility of collusion.
Absolutely. And we're also seeing instances where even in businesses where there are a number of players, participants in a market, they all use the same pricing software, this algorithm that tells them, actually, here's what all your competitors are doing. And if you raise your price a little bit and they raise their price a little bit, we can get this done. Instead of having three CEOs go into a room and collude to raise prices, three CEOs use the same pricing software and the pricing software tells it to raise prices. And there's no like algorithmic software, antidote to the antitrust laws. That's still illegal. And we have the DOJ and the FTC pursuing cases along those lines.
Now, to wrap this up, because I bring everything back to we get what we get because of the government we vote for. So the people that we put into those positions who make these decisions, the people who appoint the folks who are at the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Labor or the NLRB or any of that stuff, these are political choices that have been made. So the, you know, the question coming out of this, you know, what have we learned from this, or have we learned anything, or should there be anything taken from this in the political world?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren is fond of using the phrase personnel is policy. And we changed personnel at the Justice Department Antitrust Division, at the Federal Trade Commission, at the NLRB, at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and we got different policies. Now, Kamala Harris is only 2 weeks into her presidential campaign. She hasn't given much indication of where she would take the country other than, you know, broadly aligning with Joe Biden's policies. Now that there's been like this CEO assault trying to get her to make changes, particularly on Lena Khan, but on other things, it would, I think, do her well to align very directly with the wins that are being taken place at the antitrust agencies. And she can come out and say, look, I'm not going to fire Lena Khan. Lena Khan's doing a good job. I'm not going to fire Jonathan Cantor. He just, found that Google was violating the antitrust laws. I think that competition is a linchpin of my overall strategy, and this is what I'm going to do. I think that would serve her very well
absolutely.
At this point.
No, absolutely. I hope she comes out aggressively in this direction, because as I've been saying for the last 3 years, I think Biden has transformationally changed the direction of the country and is moving us in a much better way, getting away from neoliberalism, reshoring manufacturing, investing in things at home. And oh, by the way, you know, starting to look at breaking up monopolies. I think we're on the right path. We need to do a lot more on all of those fronts, but we're heading, the ship is heading in the right direction.
Yeah, and we need to make sure that we stay in that direction. And, you know, I mean, I suspect as we go forward in this election, there are going to be a lot of opportunities for Vice President Harris to make herself clear on those points.
I'm right there with you. David, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the work that you do over at the American Prospect. Hope folks will take a look at the website, prospect.org, to take a look at that. David Dayan, thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Are we excited by the prospect that maybe, possibly, we're going to start going after and restoring competition in the marketplace? Maybe a little bit? rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1835. That was the day that began the Baltimore Bank Riot. The Bank of Maryland had failed in 1834. Thousands of people who had deposited money in the bank saw their savings vanish. For nearly a year and a half, the depositors wanted their money to be returned. Anger grew. Some of that anger was directed at one of the bank's directors, Reverdy Johnson. The bank directors were accused of fraud and speculation that had caused the bank's failure. The bank officials were also dragging their feet on settling accounts with bank clients because the directors wanted to keep their personal fortunes. A crowd gathered around Director Johnson's house and broke out some windows. The mayor of Baltimore ordered a troop of 30 armed guards to protect Johnson's residence. The next day, the angry mob turned their attention to another director, John Glenn. They began to demolish his home before the mounted guards stopped the damage. 2 days later, the mob returned to Director Johnson's home. This time, they were able to overpower the guards. They piled up Johnson's property in the street and set it on fire. The crowd swelled and moved on to destroy property of other bank directors. Revolutionary War veteran Sam Smith organized a militia of 3,000 men to stop the destruction. The leaders of the bank protest were arrested and jailed. The bank directors received $100,000 from the state as compensation for the destruction of their property. The bankers were not held responsible for their actions, which caused the bank to fail. Does this sound familiar? Most of the bankers who caused the 2008 crash also never faced consequences.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Monday had a dramatic stock day. Things not good on Monday. True to form, Donald Trump blamed Vice President Kamala Harris. Now understand, the vice president is not in charge. The argument would be, this is Joe Biden's fault. It's all Biden's fault. And had Biden been the candidate, I'm sure it would have been. Now, what's interesting about this is you go, look, Republicans have been cheerleading for a crash. They've been cheerleading for a recession. They've been wanting some bad economic news so they can go, see, look what he did. You know, after 3 years of job growth, you have one bad month. It's like, oh, see what Joe Biden did? Never mind all of that. Don't look back there. But here's the weird thing. Trump has taken credit for all of these months of job growth. He says that he, Donald Trump, deserves credit for everything that Biden's done, but not this. No. This is where, I guess, this is the demarcation line. And this is what Trump does very well. He takes credit for good things and, well, blames everyone else for all the bad stuff. And that's, look, if you can get away with it in your head, great. But the rest of us know better. So here we are. Now, who could have seen this coming? On Monday, a Virginia man was charged with making death threats against Vice President Kamala Harris. Shocker. And I expect more of this, especially as Trump ramps up what some are calling undisciplined attacks. I would call, you know, his visceral, his true, honest feelings, you know, that low IQ dumb person over there that's running against me, who I refuse to debate. It's as if he's a little afraid. He then went after, you know, popular swing state governor, who, you know, I don't know, he might need in November. You know, seems like, you know, Brian Kemp could be helpful to the Trump folks. Maybe. Thoughts? But here's the thing. And what you're seeing before us is the guy's literally losing it right before our very eyes. Because I think he realizes that, the polls be a-changing. Some more bad news for Trump. Evidently, and this is a weird thing, I don't know why Andrew Bailey, the attorney general of Missouri, thought it was Missouri's job to file a case, a lawsuit against New York, I guess it was, on the hush money case, trying to get, you know, it thrown out, you know, because Trump evidently convicted of falsifying business records to pay off a porn star. I don't know why Missouri's job was that, but the Supreme Court shut it down and lifted the gag order in the hush money case. So I guess we'll be seeing some of that. And finally. As we've been talking about how weird things are, I think Robert Kennedy Jr., I think he's going to get the weird award. I think he's right there. This story about the dead bear is, I mean, next level cuckoo. And I got to wonder, you know, substance involved. Now, the story goes, evidently he saw a woman hit a small bear. He decided he was going to pull it over because he's going to go home and skin it and eat it. That was the thought. But he had a function to go to, so he picked up the dead bear, put it in the back of his car, drove to the function. He was a little late, didn't have time to go back to home to, you know, to do the deed, and, you know, was supposed to take a flight. this is the story. So the dead bear has been in the car for hours, just because, hey, it's what you do, and, you know. Look, I've known people who've picked up roadkill in the past. They're poor people and rednecks. And I say that in a positive term. I know I have a lot of redneck friends. But these are people who, you know, they will pick up roadkill. And not a guy like Robert Kennedy Jr., at least I thought. And then he decides, well, I don't have time to go and do the deed at home and skin the little bear and then eat it. After it's been hit and sitting in my car, you know, for hours and hours, which again, you know, my hunter friends say, not great. But decides this idea that we're gonna play a prank on the citizens of New York, and we're gonna take the bear and a broken down bicycle, and we're gonna stage a a roadkill event where people will be confused at how a bicycle ran over a bear and killed it. I got to tell you, someone throws that up at me, I'm suggesting help. But now here's the other part. He could face charges for this. Yeah. Wouldn't that be, I guess it's another reason you don't run for president, because everything comes out. Yeah, I guess, I don't know if he leaked this because, hey, I need attention or what, but let's talk high level weird. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Podcast. Also, you can go to freespeech.org. Find the video right there. Weird. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.